move forward. What the Europeans have been doing with the recognition of the Palestinian state and this new law about the labels is trying to, within the framework of the reality that exists today, which recognizes the occupation of Palestine, to show some measure of resistance and say, look, we're doing something for the Palestinians. So we're recognizing a state that does not exist. We're pretending that there is a Palestinian ambassador, although there is no Palestinian state, so the ambassador represents no one. Along that same line, they're saying, well, we're going to label these, we're going to consider those particular areas as illegal settlements, and those are the ones that we're going to label. And then go figure out exactly which ones are they're going to consider the illegal and which ones are not. You know, how exactly they're going to do this is a whole other question. So it's a small measure that just to relieve some of the pressure and show that they are showing some measure of respect and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, but in effect doing nothing. You know, if they wanted to really do something, they would say we are boycotting all Israeli products because all of Israel is occupied Palestine. All Israeli towns and cities are illegal settlements, which is what they are. The occupation of 48 was no more legal than the occupation that, you know, that took place in 1967, and one was a continuation of the other. If they wanted to do something, they would say, we recognize that all of Palestine is occupied, that Palestinians live under an oppressive apartheid regime that needs to end, not recognize a state that doesn't exist and a government that represents no one, which is really what the Palestinian Authority is. So if the Europeans, but I believe that this is coming. I think right now the Europeans are behaving the way they are because they can get away with it. I think future European governments are not going to be able to get away with it because the pro-Palestinian voice in Europe is getting stronger and louder, and their constituents are going to demand that they do more.
We've been speaking with Mikko Peled, the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The book, I should mention, has a foreword by Alice Walker. Mikko, you write towards the end of your book that, quote, in the long run, the Zionist state is a disaster for Jews as well as it is for Palestinians. It completely undermined, not to say destroyed, Jewish culture and traditions, both European and Middle Eastern. Can you expand on that thought?
Well, you know, here in America, there used to be, and in Europe certainly too, there used to be a real Jewish culture. A European Jewish culture. There was language, there was literature, there was poetry, there was activism. They spoke Yiddish. They wrote in Yiddish, and they were activists, and they were progressive, and they were anarchists, and there was a whole culture of Jews. All of that has been replaced by this new fake religion called the State of Israel. And today, Jews, in order to identify yourself as a Jew, you have to support the State of Israel. So Zionism killed it and took over. In terms of Arab Jews, there used to be rich, flourishing Arab Jewish communities, and they're all gone. And they're only gone because Zionism created this rift between Jewish communities in the Arab world and the Arab world. And so those are gone. And then the Arab Jews who did come to Palestine had to, and become Israelis, had to sound like me and look like me, which is European. So their culture in Israel was also destroyed. And therefore, I say that Zionism was a disaster and destructive for Jews as well as Palestinians. Jewish culture was destroyed as a result of it.
We've unfortunately run out of time. I'll just repeat, you were the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. We're grateful for your being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
It's KBOO Portland. You listen to special programming for the KBOO's Morning News and Public Affairs block. Coming up, Syrian tragedy, causes, consequences, and options. This is a talk by Professor, I believe it's Stephen Zunis. So let's just get right to it. On KBOO Portland, your community radio.
Basically, what I'm saying is that yes, there's the horrific repression of the Assad regime, the evaporation of the nonviolent struggle, you know, was a major cause of the rise of ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State, whatever you want to call it. But a lot of the blame, frankly, goes to the United States for our intervention in Iraq. If it had not been for the invasion of Iraq, there would be no ISIS. I mean, some conspiracy theorists say we somehow created ISIS or were secretly arming ISIS. No, it was a direct consequence, again, I would argue, of the U.S. intervention.
That's Professor Stephen Zunis speaking about the Syrian tragedy, and this is a program by Global Voices for Justice, a nonprofit media organization. I'm Jeannie Kyle. Professor Zunis teaches political science and international studies at the University of San Francisco. He is a senior foreign policy analyst for the Focus Project. Dr. Zunis is a prolific writer on the Middle East, Africa, the U.S., and many other topics, published on his website at stephenzunis.org. That's stephenzunis.org. His most recent books are Western Sahara and Nonviolent Social Movements. Professor Zunis gave a talk about the Syrian tragedy, causes, consequences, and options at the University of Redlands, California, on October 21st, 2015.
Thank you, Ethan. I really appreciate y'all bringing me back here. And you know, last time I was here, I talked about Israel and Palestine, and now I'm being asked to talk about what, believe it or not, may be an even more complex problem. And one with no easy solutions. I have spent time in the Middle East, and including a number of trips to Syria prior to the outbreak of the war, where I met with some top government officials, including the foreign minister and others, as well as dissidents, academics, and others. But my main impressions of Syria was one of the most beautiful countries I've ever been to. The natural beauty of the mountains, the great archaeological wonders, great water wheels, and Hama, the homes that the Crusader castles, the Palmyra, the Roman ruins, the best preserved in the world. Aleppo, one of my absolutely favorite cities I've ever been to, with its ancient streets and the great fortress in the middle of the city where we can overlook it. And it was a place that seemed very, very authentic, very real. I was never a fan of the government, as you might imagine, but the country and its people have always been very dear to my heart. And so to see it descend into this kind of tragedy has been personally painful for me, and even though it's my job to analyze, being an area of specialization in my academic work, it's been a hard one for me, frankly, because I know so many people there, many of whom are now dead. I wanted to start by just giving a little history of the country. Syria, of course, is an ancient society. Damascus is one of the longest inhabited cities in the world, going back well over 4,000 years. The street called Straight is the oldest street in the world. I've walked there, and I've seen where the Apostle Paul, the Lord in a basket. That building is still there. It's just remarkable. Yet the modern boundaries of what we call Syria are like most boundaries in the Middle East and Africa and other parts of the previously colonized world are pretty artificial. Indeed, Lebanon was deliberately carved out by the Syrians out of Syria, where they could have a Christian minority loyal to the French, could have predominate politically and set up the sectarian system, which has caused so many problems there. The French did some similar work in Syria. They used the Alawites, a religious minority, a Muslim a sect that represents about 12% of the population. They used them disproportionately in the military they were trying to build up. among military officers. They hope to be loyal to France. This is similar to what, you know, the favoritism of a minority is an old trick of colonial powers. We saw the British use the Sikhs in India, the British use the Igbos in Nigeria, the Americans use the Hmong in Laos, and in a similar way, the French use the Alawites. The country, you know, finally, you know, became independent in the 1940s. 1949, they had a free election that elected a left-leaning nationalist government. But in apparent cahoots with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, there was a military coup which overthrew this government. And that was the last free election the country had. It's been a series of military governments. Through the 50s and beyond, they tended to lean more to the left, more nationalistic. During the Cold War, Syria allied, though technically non-aligned, was in many respects allied to the Soviet Union. They adopted a strong pan-Arabist ideology. In fact, for several years in the late 50s, early 60s, they merged with Egypt to become one country called the United Arab Republic. The goal is to get all the Arab countries eventually into one nation, but Egypt, you know, the Syrians didn't feel they were getting a good end of the deal and renewed their independence a few years later. In 1967, in the Arab-Israeli War that June, Israel ended up conquering the southwestern part of the country, taking over half of the Golan province. It remains as occupied territory, Israeli occupied territory, ever since. Most of the Syrian population was ethnically cleansed, though there is a small series of Jews communities that are still consider themselves Syrians that have periodically engaged in nonviolent resistance against the Israeli occupation and settlements there. In 1970, there was a coup by the head of the Air Force, a man named Bashar Assad. He instituted a one-man rule and organized state services into sectarian lines, where the Sunnis, the majority, would be the formal heads of the political institutions, while the Alawites are given control over the military, intelligence, and security apparatuses. Now, this was not sectarian in the sense of religion, per se. Indeed, the Ba'athist movement and the Assad family are pretty secular in their orientation. But it was a means, given the history of coups in that country, it was basically a way where Assad could be assured of remaining in control. Despite not giving lip service to the Palestinian cause, Assad did more harm than good. The Palestinian refugees that had fled Israel during the original ethnic cleansing in 1948 were largely sequestered to their camps and not the refugee camps and not granted citizenship status. And what support he gave for the opposition tended to be some extremist groups, including some pretty notorious terrorist groups that killed a number of Israeli civilians, hijacked airliners, and engaged in other acts of terror. In 1975, Syria intervened in the Lebanese Civil War, ironically, with the support of the United States, trying to crush a victory by a coalition of Lebanese leftists and Palestinians. But internally, he focused on establishing a kind of authoritarian, secular, semi-socialist, you know, kind of political system. It got resentment from a number of quarters in society, both left and right. A hardline Islamist uprising in 1982 was savagely suppressed in the city of Hama, you know, basically where the hardcore Islamist, Sunni Islamists ended up taking over the heart of the city. Basically, he surrounded, Assad's forces surrounded the city and just bombed and shelled and bombed and shelled for days, resulting in the deaths of as many as 10,000 people, mostly civilians. Between 1982 and 1984, the United States actually engaged Syrian forces in Lebanon when the U.S. militarily intervened after Israel's invasion. We killed quite a few Syrians. They shot down a couple of our planes, you know, killing a couple of American pilots. Yet they are still willing to cooperate with the United States in areas of mutual concern. For example, they sent troops to Saudi Arabia in 1990 as part of Operation Desert Shield in reaction to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Even though Saddam was a fellow Ba'athist, the government in Syria was always very hostile, you know, towards the Iraqis, even to the point of being willing to ally with the United States in opposition to Iraq's aggression. In fact, their opposition to Iraq was so strong, they're the only Arab country to back Iran during the Iran-Iraq War during the 1980s. With the support of the United States in December of 1990, just before the Gulf War, the United States supports Syria in staging a coup against a Maronite general allied with Saddam Hussein, who himself had seized power in a coup a couple of months earlier. This, of course, led Syria to end up dominating Lebanese affairs. And it's kind of ironic that the man we helped Syria overthrow later became supported by the United States, and the Syrians' rule in Lebanon, which we initially supported, became the subject of a U.S. hostility. In the 1990s, the government of Assad moderated somewhat. It stopped supporting terrorist groups, opened up the political system at least a little bit, and yet the United States kept it on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. I actually interviewed the U.S. ambassador in Damascus about this, and he admitted that, yes, we hadn't seen evidence of them supporting terrorism in recent years, but we're keeping them on the list as leverage to pressure them to be more open to certain U.S. diplomatic initiatives. And this is the first time many of us had long suspected it, but it was the first time I'd heard it from somebody as high-ranking as U.S. ambassador admit that the terrorism list, the State Department list of state sponsors of terrorism was based at least as much on political concerns as their actual involvement in such activities. The other way Syria moderated was that in its longstanding hostility towards Israel and was willing to recognize Israel's right to exist, have full diplomatic and economic relations, allow for international peacekeeping force and demilitarizing the border region if Israel would withdraw from the occupied Golan Heights. And the argument came down literally to a couple hundred yards of where the boundary would actually be. When the talks broke off, everybody assumed they would be resuming shortly, but Bashar Assad died, and it ended up cutting off the talks. By the time Syria was willing to resume, the hardline right-wing government had come to power in Israel and no longer wanted to pursue negotiations. And the United States, which for years had pushed Syria to support the Land for Peace formula, backed away and basically started supporting Israel's position that they'd be able to hold on to the occupied territories even if its Arab neighbor wanted to make peace. When Hafez Assad died, he was replaced by his son Bashir. His first choice was his son, Basel, but he ended up dying in a car accident. So he groomed his son, Bashir, who is not much of a political figure. I mean, he was an ophthalmologist trained in Britain. He had no interest in politics. But his father basically wanted him to succeed. And there's some irony here, because the whole idea of the Ba'athist movement and this kind of a Republican revolution in the Arab world was to get away from the archaic, anachronistic tradition of hereditary leadership. And initially, he opened up the system somewhat. It was known as the Damascus Spring. There was more dissent and cultural life bloomed. People were excited that there might actually be hope for democracy, but the door shut relatively quickly. This was short-lived. And remained this kind of love-hate relationship with the United States. After the 9/11 tragedy, the Syrian government helped the United States in trying to crack down al-Qaeda. In fact, even took part in the so-called extraordinary rendition program where the CIA would kidnap suspects of terrorists, send them to countries where they would be tortured, and if they found people of Syrian background, they would send them to Damascus to be tortured. One of them happened to be a Canadian citizen who was perfectly innocent, but had the same last name as a terrorist suspect, and he was sent to Damascus and tortured for a better part of a year before the U.S. and the Syrians realized he was actually innocent. But despite this cooperation, the United States saw Syria in a negative light, and Congress almost unanimously passed a law in 2004 called the Syrian Accountability Act, which imposed very, very strict sanctions on it. And it was based on, in order for the sanctions to be lifted, Syria had to withdraw its forces from Lebanon in accordance to the UN Security Council Resolution 425, which called for all foreign troops to leave Lebanon. What's interesting, though, is that that resolution was passed 30 years earlier, and the only country they mentioned by name was Israel. But the U.S. had supported Israel's occupation of Lebanon. Israel had unilaterally withdrew from Lebanon in 2000, but now we're insisting it had to be enforced in the case of Syria. And, of course, most Lebanese wanted Syria out. They should have been out. They were violating it. But the Syrians said, why are you suddenly interested in enforcing this resolution when you blocked enforcement of the resolution back when it primarily involved Israel? The resolution also claimed that Iraq was supporting the armed resistance, the U.S. occupation forces in Iraq, which was a bit bizarre because the main forces fighting the United States were pro-Saddam or Islamist extremists, both of which the Syrian regime had opposed. They also insisted that they returned, that the sanctions not be lifted until direct Syrian-Israeli peace talks resumed, even though it was the Israelis who broke it off, not the Syrians. And furthermore, they claimed that they had made exaggerated claims about Syria having Syria's supposed weapons of mass destruction. They were known to have a chemical weapons stockpile, but they cited John Bolton, who in the same testimony claimed that Cuba was developing biological weapons and other bizarre allegations that were later found to be false. He and who was one of the big people promoting the scare tactics around Iraq. This is the same person that was cited in this Senate resolution. And also they insisted that Syria unilaterally disarm its missiles, even though Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia, others had more sophisticated missiles that had unilaterally get rid of their chemical weapons, even though Israel and Egypt still had their chemical weapons. And I could go on, but what was striking about this resolution is that even though the concerns raised about Syria in many cases were valid, some cases exaggerated, the behaviors that Syria were involved in were very similar to the behaviors of countries allied to the United States. And so Syria felt they could just reject these demands. But it was quite striking the fact that there's hardly a single, I think there may be six dissenting votes, or two dissenting votes, in both houses of Congress. I think four members abstained. Quite bizarre that nobody actually pointed out some of the inaccuracies within the wording and the double standard. And this extreme anti-Syrian stuff has gone back for many years. Even my own union, the American Federation of Teachers, passed a resolution in 2006 claiming that Syria was supplying Hamas with sophisticated missiles and Hamas attacks on Israel were being done at the bidding of Syria. But in reality, Syria and Hamas have very bad relations. They've never sent them sophisticated missiles. In fact, Hamas is actively supporting the Islamist opposition, attacking and fighting the Assad regime this day. But it's a sort of example of how it made it very difficult, basically, here in the United States to have much rational discourse on Syria, and why many Syrians, even those opposing the government, frankly, do not trust the United States and our intentions there. Indeed, in 2006, Bush pushed the Prime Minister Olmert of Israel to launch a massive attack on Lebanon and Syria in anticipation of a planned attack on Iran, which didn't happen for various other reasons. But the Israel did go ahead and attack Lebanon. They did not think they had what it took to attack Syria simultaneously, and even the war in Lebanon against the Hezbollah militants there ended up being a disaster. That too was supported by a large bipartisan majority. In 2007, the Assad regime tried to again with a coalition government in Israel, thought maybe they could make peace. Again, they offered all the formula of land for peace, you know, that people have been talking about for years, that Israelis had supposedly wanted for years. The Israeli cabinet considered it. We're considering it. When Condoleezza Rice, U.S. Secretary of State, you know, called the Israeli Prime Minister Olmert and said, don't even think about it. The President of Israel, Shimon Peres, admitted that it was U.S. pressure that got them to say no, because he pointed out that the Bush administration had few friends that Israel had in the world. We don't want to displease them by making peace with Israel. Basically, what the United States wanted to do, you know, was to, we were afraid that if Assad succeeded in getting their land back that had been occupied all these years by Israel, he'd be seen as a national hero and it would strengthen his rule. And again, the goal of the Bush administration was regime change in Syria. That's why he put these strict sanctions that, you know, no government could reasonably abide by because you're so one-sided. There was an active effort to try to bring down the regime. But many Syrians were thinking about bringing down the regime. They are more and more dissatisfied. The one form of liberalization that the younger Assad had put on was economic liberalization. And when you have economic liberalization without political liberalization, you end up with a network of crony capitalists, an incredible economic inequality, rampant corruption, and the people of Syria, especially as a drought worsened, many people, many of which people attribute to climate change, created greater and greater dissent. And it's interesting to point out that despite the socialist rhetoric of the government, the opposition that took to the streets in 2011 had a stronger working class base than any of the Arab Spring revolutions. It was very broad-based, across class lines, across religious lines, across ethnic lines. It was a very broad-based movement. Wanting a more democratic, more inclusive Syria. It was overwhelmingly nonviolent. And as someone who's studied mass nonviolent civil insurrections in dozens of countries in recent decades, I know of no people who demonstrated such courage and fortitude in the face of such savage repression as did the people of Syria. Assad could have done what the autocratic leaders in Jordan and Oman and Morocco did. He could have enacted a few reforms that might have placated the opposition, opened things up a little bit while still, you know, maintaining a firm grip on power. Instead, he unleashed his security service to massacre people by the hundreds and then by the thousands. Indeed, he singled out leading advocates of nonviolence because he saw them as a bigger threat than people who might take up arms. I know one guy who had translated the works of Gene Sharp, the nonviolent theorist based at Harvard. He was singled out and to be tortured to death because they saw these subversive writings telling people how they can organize nonviolently as a threat to the regime. Indeed, he even ordered his special forces, to snipers, to shoot at regular police and military to make them think that they were being shot at by the nonviolent protesters, so they would then return fire and thus justify the massacres. Now, many people are wondering, why did Syria fail where, you know, in Tunisia and in Egypt, at least initially, and in Yemen partially, you had, you know, nonviolent movements were able to bring down the dictators. Some people say, oh, it's because of Assad's cruelty. But it's not really cruelty per se. I mean, and Ben Ali ordered his troops to massacre people by the thousands, and they refused. There was over 1,000 people were killed in only 18 days in Egypt, which was a higher rate during the months of the uprising in Syria. So it's not just the killing of people that keeps the repression that keeps the regime in power. Indeed, that can have a backfire effect, where it gets more people out in the streets, and that seemed to be what was going on in Syria. I think the reason was that in the case of Ben Ali in Tunisia, Nasser in Egypt, Gaddafi in Libya, Saleh in Yemen, they were, it's more or less one-man rule. They did not have much of a social base. Their popularity in their final years was in the single digits, probably, or at least under 20% for sure. Assad, that regime was very different because it was not just one-man rule. It was more like an oligarchy, in the sense that you had the Ba'ath Party, which had been in power more or less for 50 years. They had offices in every town, every neighborhood. Actively recruited people as members. They had a unifying ideology. The military, almost everybody had been in the military and had families, officers who benefited from the system. You had the sectarian divisions. You had large minorities, not just of Alawites, but of Christians, who are about 10% of the population, of Shias and Druze, who felt that Assad, as bad as he was, was at least protection from the more hardcore fundamentalist extremist types that might come to power if the Sunni majority ever gained power. So you had this kind of divide and rule strategy. On top of that, there was the crony capitalist class that benefited from government support. Those are mostly Sunni business people. So if you take a decent percentage, though not all, of the religious minorities, combined with those that have close personal ties to the party and the military, and as well as the economic interest, you have a good 30, 40% of the population. So whether your struggle is nonviolent or violent, if you're going against a regime that has a social base, even though it's a minority, if it's a big enough minority, it's going to be much harder than going against one-man rule. We saw this in the leftist revolutions, for example, that Somoza was pretty easy to overthrow in Nicaragua, whereas in El Salvador it was more of an oligarchical system. It became much more difficult.
You're listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice. You can visit our website at globalvoicesforjustice.org or reach us at 310-283-0885. This is a talk by Professor Stephen Zunis about the Syrian tragedy, causes, consequences, and options, and was given at the University of Redlands, California, on October 21st, 2015.
You also had the problem that there was civil society was weaker in Syria than it had been in Tunisia and in Egypt. Assad had been able to manipulate the strong sense of nationalism that the people had and that the Syrians have long had in the face of threats from the West, the Israeli occupation, and the like. So basically, it was a real challenge. It was clear that Assad was not going to fall within a matter of weeks, as had been the case in the other Arab revolutions. But people people were so angry, so frustrated at the massacres. Many people were saying, we need to take up arms. And they pointed out how Libya had started out nonviolently. They took up arms, and then the West came to the rescue in terms of military intervention. Maybe they'll do that if we take up arms as well. It ended up being a disastrous decision. Because turning to armed struggle just gave the regime the excuse for even greater repression. The large-scale defections from the military and the police, which originally formed the basis of the so-called Free Syrian Army, largely stopped. Soldiers are much more likely to defect if they're being ordered to shoot into crowds of unarmed protesters than if they're being shot at themselves. And the big problem, of course, was that as the armed struggle continued, the hardline Islamist groups gained the ascendancy. The Free Syrian Army really wasn't much of an army. The Pentagon estimated that it was as literally as many as 1,000 separate militia acting not in coordination of each other, with each other. They ranged in ideology. They ranged in their military preparedness, but they were weak from the very beginning. But the Islamists ended up dominating, and many of the FSA units got overrun by the Islamists, or in the course of the struggle, they became radicalized. And I knew a number of stories of young fighters who started off as moderate and secular, but as the struggle continued, and out of their desperation and the horror that was around them, embraced this very reactionary, militaristic, chauvinistic version of Islam. We then came to the rise of ISIS. Now, I would bringing the war to the cities gave the regime the excuse to unleash extreme brutality, massive bombings of crowded civilian neighborhoods. Reputable human rights groups have investigated and documented crimes against humanity of an extraordinary degree. Thousands of civilians are being killed every month. During the nonviolent phase of the struggle, 5,000 civilians were killed, roughly. Since then, it is literally, the death toll has gone up 50 times. And nearly 250,000 people have died. At least two-thirds of them have, or three-quarters of them have been civilians. 7.5 million people, about a third of the country's population, have been displaced. 4 million of them are in exile as refugees. Though it's interesting, and I just want to mention, we've gotten heard a lot of attention in Europe about a couple hundred thousand refugees that have fled into Europe. But remember, the overwhelming majority of refugees are hosted by countries that are a lot poorer and a lot less capable of supporting them than the European ones. I want to talk a little bit about the rise of ISIS, since they're the ones that are kind of on people's minds. You know, they've ended up being even more ruthless and deadly than the government. Not in terms of the total numbers killed. That's primarily from the regime, because they have an air force and can drop bombs in crowded areas. But we've all heard the stories, the ruthless control of ISIS, the beheadings, the executions, mass kidnappings and rapes and the like. There are times, when the United States has exaggerated stories of various terrorist groups, guerrilla groups we don't like, but from everything I'm aware of, this is, the horror of ISIS is not exaggerated. This is a fanatical cult, has about as much to do with Islam as the Branch Davidians or the neo-Nazi Christian identity groups have with Christianity. If you look at the original caliphates, the original caliphates that they're claiming to be emulating actually gave autonomy and rights for the Jewish and Christian minorities, including their own court systems. They respected the archaeological treasures of pre-Islamic times. These certainly weren't democracies by 20th century Western standards, but they were nothing like the horror that's being inflicted in the name of Islam, by this group of fanatics. But I want to tell a little bit about how they emerged. Their leadership is largely Iraqi. Many military commanders were actually members of the Iraqi army, who suddenly found themselves unemployed when the United States invaded the country. And instead of just purging the top officers loyal to Saddam, ended up eliminating the entire armed forces. So you had these embittered, unemployed men who were able to take home their guns and military training and become guerrilla fighters. The other problem was that the other bastion of secular nationalism in Iraq the United States got rid of was the civil service. Basically, we said any member of the Ba'athist Party can no longer be a member of government. But since you had to be a member of the Ba'athist Party to work in the civil service, that pretty much eliminated everybody, and they became personal fiefdoms of the these Shiite sectarian parties that ended up dominating Iraq after the U.S. invasion. And the new Iraqi army was organized primarily by the Badr Corps, which was the armed wing of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a pro-Iranian group. In fact, the Badr Corps had actually been armed and trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. They fought on Iran's side on the Iran-Iraq War. So to many Iraqis, particularly the Sunnis, who are strongest in terms of the sense of Arab nationalism, they saw their government being taken over by these pro-Iranian factions, you know, that had killed their fellow Iraqis in this long, bloody war in the 1980s, that they got in power by virtue of an invasion by traditional imperialist powers, the United States and Britain, that they'd also opposed. Their historic enemies had kind of taken over. And who made that possible? It was the Iraqi Shias, who are just as Arab as they were, who were their neighbors. And there'd been intermarriage, you know, between the Sunnis and Shias and small towns, only one mosque, Sunnis and Shias worship together. I mean, theologically, there's less difference between Sunnis and Shias than there are between Catholics and Protestants. And they had not been fighting each other for years. I mean, Saddam Hussein was ruthless against Shia groups that kind of organized as Shia groups. But if you look at the ruling Ba'ath Party, at least a third of the top leaders were Shia. It was a secular nationalist regime. What I'm saying is that the sectarian fighting that helped greatly give rise to ISIS was not something that grew spontaneously out of, oh, they've been fighting each other for centuries, but it was a direct consequence of the U.S. invasion and post-occupation U.S. policies. Now, one of the groups that had been fighting the United States and the government, there were like 40 armed groups fighting U.S. troops after the invasion, but one of the, though this it was a minority, one of the deadliest and most dangerous was the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had sprung up in the Sunni-dominated areas. But many of the Sunni tribesmen who had been fighting the U.S. and the Iraqi government said, you know, these Al-Qaeda guys are even scarier. If the Maliki government, the U.S.-backed Shia, an Iranian-backed Shia government, would incorporate Sunnis back into the army, back into the government, we will join your side in fighting Al-Qaeda. And they did. And Al-Qaeda was largely defeated. In fact, it was this agreement, much more than the so-called surge, which led to a lessening of the fighting. But the Maliki government didn't go through their end of the deal, and the sectarian tensions remained. And again, they're not fighting each other for theological reasons. If you think, for example, when speaking of Catholics and Protestants, think of Northern Ireland. Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland were not killing each other for their religious differences, per se, but because of various historic reasons. The Protestants identified with Britain, and the Catholics with the Irish Republic. It was competing nationalisms, and there was sort of an assumption if you were a Protestant, you sided with Britain, if you were a Catholic, you sided with Ireland, and so when the IRA or the Ulster Unionists would plant bombs in the other people's pubs, you know, killing random civilians, and the tit-for-tat killings that went on, you know, for several decades. Again, it was about how the religion became fused with the national identity in this nationalist struggle. Similarly, the fighting in Iraq initially was about the sense by some Sunnis that the Shias were collectively responsible for, you know, for taking Iraq out of the Arab orbit and into that of the Western powers and of Iran. But whatever the reasons, it more and more evolved into one that was more sectarian. Suddenly, who you were did make a difference. And there was mutual ethnic cleansing, religious cleansing, if you will. And in recent years, the Sunnis started using nonviolent protests and tent cities and other kinds of efforts to try civil resistance, to try to get the Maliki government to fulfill its end of the bargain. They responded by brutal repression, including massacres. And so when this new shadowy group, ISIS, emerged out of the remnants of the old Al-Qaeda in Iraq, they were actually welcomed by the Sunni communities, saying, how could they be worse than the Iraqi government? Well, they were. And the Iraqi government didn't. The army was so corrupt and everything, they just, you know, threw down their weapons, and ISIS picked them up along with banks, you know, full of gold, along with all sorts of other oil and other resources, and this enabled them to increase to move into Syria, with more arms, more money, and take over large swaths of territory in that country as well. Of course, they don't recognize Iraq and Syria. That's why they use terms like the Levant or others, in the sense that they see these boundaries as, again, artificial colonial constructs that they don't recognize. So basically what I'm saying is that yes, the horrific repression of the Assad regime, the evaporation of the nonviolent struggle, was a major cause of the rise of ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State, whatever you want to call it. But a lot of the blame, frankly, goes to the United States for our intervention in Iraq. If it had not been for the invasion of Iraq, there would be no ISIS. I mean, some conspiracy theorists say we somehow created ISIS or were secretly arming ISIS. No, we're very disturbed at the rise of ISIS. But it was a direct consequence, again, I would argue, of the U.S. intervention. Indeed, if you look at ISIS's military equipment, and this has led to some of the conspiracy theories, but you will notice that the vast majority is U.S. made. Now, the U.S. did not arm ISIS directly with this, but they were able to capture it from the Iraqi army, capture it from rival rebel groups in Syria, some of which were armed by the United States, and others armed through U.S. allies in the Persian Gulf, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who get their arms from the U.S. But it's contributed to the horror that we're seeing unfold in that country. And it's led to a lot of difficult questions. What can we do now? Well, it's interesting because during the fall semester 2 years ago, I was having to explain to my students why the United States appeared to be on the verge of going to war against the Syrian government. And then last fall, I was having to explain to my students why the United States was going to war against Syrian rebels. initially the big concern, of course, was the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian regime, a horrific attack which killed over 1,000 innocent civilians. But the direct confrontation was averted when Russia was able to negotiate Syria's belated entry into the chemical weapons treaty and disarm them, even though other forms of mass killings, unfortunately, by the regime have continued. Now we have ISIS as seen as the bigger threat. And U.S. has begun airstrikes against ISIS, along with Britain, France, the Jordanians, Saudis, and more recently, Russia. The latter is of concern to the United States because Russia appears not to be bombing just ISIS, but also some of the more moderate groups that the U.S. supports. Russia's agenda seems to be more at propping up Assad. Where the United States would like to see Assad go, but also, of course, see ISIS suppressed. And in many ways, let me just mention a bit on the Russian perspective. I mean, to the Russians, the Middle East is like Latin America is to us. And for those of you who remember the Cold War, remember how the United States was quite willing to support all sorts of thugs and dictators and rationalize for war crimes in the name of fighting what we call terrorists, that was, leftist rebels. Russia is engaging a similar kind of policy, only the difference being that usually in Latin America, the case of the Soviet penetration was greatly exaggerated, whereas in the case of the Middle East, the United States really is become the hegemonic power with the U.S. Wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and military bases all throughout the area and a number of regimes that were once pro-Russian, having been overthrown and taken a more pro-Western orientation. So the Russians have their strategic rationale for that, but I would argue that there's absolutely no justification for this kind of intervention, especially anything that supports Assad. Well, does any kind of military intervention make sense, given what's there? And I have a hard time with this question in a lot of ways, because I feel like, if policymakers had listened to me, we wouldn't be in this mess. So now they turn to me and say, okay, what do we do now? And I'm personally skeptical about military intervention. My own background, I grew up in a Christian pacifist family, and so the idea of endorsing any kind of military intervention, even on humanitarian grounds, is a tough one to me. At the same time, we are faced with unprecedented threat in terms of ISIS. Not to mention, people can make it, can certainly make a case in terms of a no-fly zone or some kind of responsibility to protect vis-a-vis the terror and repression by Assad. At the same time, I'm open to being convinced that some kind of targeted military intervention is worthwhile, is morally and legally defensible. But I am still not convinced yet. I do this for a couple of reasons. First of all, the United States has been bombing that part of the world on and off for a good quarter century now, and we seem to have only made things worse. Secondly, the fact is that most of the fighting is taking place in crowded urban areas. The killings of civilians is inevitable in these cases. And even though Assad and ISIS are responsible for far more civilian deaths overall, when the U.S. does end up killing civilians, and we have by the hundreds in our strikes in Syria over the past year or so, it plays right into the hands of both the regime and of ISIS, that here are these Western imperialist powers once again coming in and intervening and killing our people. And they have reminders of this. If you drive through Syria, you'll see the remnants of Crusader castles. These people have a long memory of Western imperialism, going back more than a millennium. Just in other words, whatever tactical advantages militarily that foreign intervention by the United States or Russia or anybody else might have, it could lead in a longer term to strategic losses politically, as people rally around the flag in terms of Assad or in terms of the black flag of ISIS, that both have been able to cynically manipulate the strong sense of nationalism, the history of resistance against colonialism, against Western invasions and intervention that's gone on in Syria and elsewhere in that part of the world for such a long time. I think the only way that air power really could make a difference would be if ISIS was being challenged by a unified popular movement, not the corrupt, brutal armed forces of Iraq or Syria. I think one area where the U.S. bombing has helped has been in the Kurdish areas of Syria, where the YPG, the armed Kurdish movement there, which has a lot of popular grassroots support, has women fighters, has a kind of a decentralized kind of socialist organization. They have been quite effective in fighting against ISIS. And again, military planners will tell you, no matter how many bombs you drop, if you're going to win a battle, you have to have somebody there on the ground with the flag, claiming that space. So you need to have people on the ground who can do it. But the Kurds, remember, are a minority. They're only 10% of the Syrian population. If ISIS is going to be defeated, it needs to be defeated, by presumably Sunni Arab Syrians. And at this point, there really is not a force that is mobilized that air power can really really support. So, there's something about. I think we may have to just wait, and that's a hard thing to say. There's something about the American persona that if we drop enough bombs, if we send enough money, if we do enough this or enough that, we can fix things. But. There are limits, that to what any outside power can do at this point, and as frustrating as that might be, we don't have a good history in that part of the world, and so oftentimes even well-intended and even for a good cause, U.S. intervention, especially the military kind, can inadvertently backfire. But a couple of things to give me a little. There are a few glimmers of hope I want to mention. One is that groups so extreme, so rigid, so ideological as ISIS can't govern in the long term. They control millions of people over wide swaths of territory. They need to keep water and electricity running. From what I can hear, they're doing a pretty bad job. more and more people are fleeing the area, not just to flee the repression, but just because things aren't working, things aren't functioning. And people are saying no in a lot of ways. Remember, nonviolent resistance is not just people being out on the streets protesting. In Syria, that can get you killed pretty quickly, as folks found out. But there are other ways of more quiet resistance. More individual resistance that can still undermine the system, and that is the fact that 90% of families, Syrian families under the control of ISIS, are not sending their kids to ISIS schools. That they do not want to be indoctrinated in this this gross distortion of Islam. You know, there are other tiny acts of non-cooperation that are going on all the time, and cumulatively, that could help. Lead to their eventual collapse. I think that things outside powers can do to perhaps hasten that. You know, would be to go after the black market, especially on the Turkish border. We do have some sway in Turkey in terms of our aid, in terms of our military bases and the like. We could really press, make it more and more difficult for ISIS to get its funding. We need to pressure our allies in Turkey and in the Gulf region to stop supporting some of the non-ISIS hardline Islamists, because often they end up working in along with ISIS on some areas. But I think, and we also need to push for diplomacy. Even with people we don't like Assad, like the Russians, like the Iranians, to try to reach some kind of settlement. But there can be the only settlement that can be reached that will last, to have any hope, would be one that includes Syrian civil society, because they're the ones that started the struggle. They these are the people who want a more democratic, inclusive Syria. They don't want Assad or ISIS. We need to do what we can to strengthen civil society. Try to get a ceasefire so people can get out of their homes, some people can return, and can start that slow process of rebuilding the popular movement that once looked so promising at making Syria a better place. Indeed, statistically, we found that nonviolent movements against dictatorships are more than twice as likely to succeed as armed struggles against dictatorships. They are more likely to succeed in a shorter time, with fewer casualties, and far more likely to have a democratic opening, or have a democratic outcome after a number of years. Again, even against brutal dictators. And we remember nonviolent resistance that brought down, it wasn't NATO that brought down the communist regimes of Eastern Europe. It was Polish dock workers, Czech intellectuals, East German church people, Estonian folk singers. It wasn't the New People's Army that brought down Marcos, the U.S.-backed dictator in the Philippines. It was nuns praying the rosary in front of the tanks and millions of others. It wasn't 11 weeks of NATO bombing that brought down Milosevic, the butcher of the Balkans in Serbia. It was young students organizing the people to rise up against a stolen election. It was not the armed wing of the ANC that brought majority rule to South Africa. It was massive civil resistance in the townships and through a revitalized labor movement combined with international sanctions made possible by nonviolent resistance in Western countries. We've seen brutal dictators from Indonesia. Suharto had more blood in his hands than Saddam Hussein. Pinochet in Chile. Even in countries like African countries, like Mali and Benin. In fact, just last year in Burkina Faso, in fact, when they staged a coup, the people rose up again, and the coup only lasted a week. You know, we've seen these kinds of movements against brutal regimes, with thousands of people die, still able to mobilize, and I still think that is a possibility. But the killing has to stop before we can see this, because the fact is the people of Syria, like people elsewhere in the region, really do desire democracy. We need to get away from the stereotype that somehow Arabs and Muslims are not ready for democracy or whatever, because I've spent enough time in that part of the world to know that Arabs and Muslims don't like to be jailed, tortured, and killed for their political beliefs any more than Western Christians do. The form a democracy may take can vary depending on a country's unique history and culture, but that desire for transparency in government, that desire for accountability, the desire for political freedom and social justice, that really is universal. And we need to encourage that impulse, you know, and that people like that take the lead in the future of Syria, not just the people with guns. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice. This talk by Professor Stephen Zunas was on the topic of the Syrian tragedy, causes, consequences, and options, given at the University of Redlands, California, on October 21st, 2015. I'm Jeannie Kyle. Global Voices for Justice is a nonprofit media organization based in Long Beach, California. To contact us or to obtain complete audio or video copies of this or other programs, please visit our website at globalvoicesforjustice.org or call us at 310-283-0885. That's 310-283-0885. Thank you for listening.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's creeping up on 11 a.m. on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2016. This is KBOO's News and Public Affairs New Year's Day special block. And it continues right after this.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tune in.